You know that there's sort of a lot going on in this cluster, major merger, subcluster. The main cluster is about 13 kV, the subcluster is like 7 kV, and there's a lot of physics going on. So you don't really know sort of what temperature you're assuming. You want to measure that. All right, so then this is a kind of a triptych observation of the bullet in three frequencies observed by SPT at 90, 100, 250, and 220 gigahertz. You'll notice right away the 90 naps noisiest, and that's just because only this for this season do we finally have 90 gigahertz detectors, which are kind of competitive in sensitivity with other frequencies. And so this is only from 2 hours of observations at 90 gigahertz versus about 13 at the other frequencies. So on 90 it stands out, you can tell it's more noisy. But then with other frequencies, and even in the 90, you can tell there is this large-scale emission, which clearly correlates between all the frequency bands, and then the bullet at the center. So this spectral discrimination is ultimately going to be really powerful for helping us determine what really is SC signal for a lot of these clusters, especially in outer regions where the signal becomes more faint. And if you want to, and if the SC is brighter at 90 gigahertz than 150 in CMB micro-K units by a factor of about 1.7. And then obviously it doesn't show up at 220. And then likewise for dusty sources, it's a factor of a few brighter, should be a factor of a few brighter at 220 than 150 gigahertz. So even though the CMB sensitivity of the 90, 150, and 220 are kind of skewed heavily, at 150 the strongest, it kind of works in the right way that the sensitivity to SZ and point source is all fairly comparable for the 2009 focal plan. If you take a power spectral density of a detector time stream, this is what you see. So as Bill say, and we scan across, the raster scans across the cluster to build up a map. We scan about at 15 arc minutes per second. So that means one arc minute scale signals show up around 15 hertz in these power spectral densities. This is a 220 gigahertz wedge of detectors, and SP is in 150 gigahertz. So the features to point out is we're not getting optical responsivity until about 100, above 15 hertz as well. That's why we chose the scan speed to be that speed. So our signal bandwidth kind of starts rolling up around 15 hertz, and then by one or one and a half hertz, depending on what frequency, the noise starts rising up dramatically just due to atmospheric emission. This goes like up like 1 over f to the 2.7 about, which is roughly what you expect. And this, not only is this signal, this noise, this atmospheric signal large, it's very correlated between the detectors. Yes?
I assume the CM is after a common mode subtraction. What's the canyon?
So that, this was just to try and three different atmosphere. Well, it's clean routine. So NN is actually a nearest neighbor clean, so it's using the pixels just around that pixel.
So the sky is not particularly common mode for you?
To some degree, it is. You can get a lot of the signal, but then if you use a template made of only the nearest neighbor pixels, you can tell it's more correlated with the nearest neighbors.
But out beyond the hertz, it doesn't make a difference.
Right. And so if you were only interested in the CMB power spectrum, you might just high pass filter this, right there, and say I don't care about that low L sound anyway. I just want a normal ELF, KSE or TSE power spectrum measurement. So for us, we're kind of on the little bit of the hairy edge for clusters because we're kind of interested in this large scale emission on sort of 10 arc minute scale. So we want to try to do as good as possible trying to clean the data, and especially at 220 gigahertz, the atmosphere becomes much more important trying to clean out these scales. And there, especially, the micro-K CMB sensitivity is much less anyway, so we want to try to do as good as possible for the 220 gigahertz to clean the CMB and the 150 gigahertz maps. And then 90, I showed 90 gigahertz, but 90 is the best of all these. There's the least amount of, lowest 1 over f mi, least amount of correlated noise, and the noise is down, and less weather-dependent. So I just wanted to quickly outline, because of this we're working at two different time stream filtering pipelines that we've developed, basically a mass pipeline and an unmasked pipeline, which are basically the same, but one just masks the cluster from the analysis. So the basic pipeline is just to deconvolve the detector time constants, which are time for 3 dB points about around 10 hertz. We low-pass filter at a frequency above the detector time constant, just so we're not aliasing any noise above where the detector has response into the maps when we make them. We remove a long time scale drift with some sort of fairly low-order polynomial. And then we do a spatial mode across the array subtraction for the mass of the optimal mass cluster. So this is just, we treat every every time sample is basically an instantaneous snapshot of what the atmosphere looks like. And for a given set of frequency detectors, we can either remove a mean, a slope, or a quadratic function across the array. So for each time sample, we remove kind of the best bits picture of what the atmosphere looks like at that time sample. And this is heavily based off of Jack Sayers did a lot of work on Bolacam, comparing and contrasting the sort of atmospheric plane. Of course, you're removing some of your signal when you're doing this, so that's why this emphasis on masking, like the cluster being at the center of your map, when it shows up in your array, it'll bias your fit to some degree. So when you mask, you're purposely not fitting that part of the map and the spatial cleaning and not biasing your results for the cluster being there. In principle, you can get better signal-to-noise performance by not masking and cleaning the whole map. But to do that, then you have to record the transfer function of the time stream filtering and make sure that you're correcting for that in the right way. But in principle, you can get better signal-to-noise, and especially at 220 gigahertz, you gain pretty quickly. Okay, so on to kind of details of the clusters we're observing. This is kind of an outline, roughly, of what our targeted cluster program plan is. We've basically just picked a couple dozen of the most massive known X-ray bright clusters with a lot of existing optical and X-ray data. A measurement of the SZ profile is a direct measure of the pressure profile, so we know we can at least get that out to large radii just from our measurements alone. And then we want to also combine that with X-ray data to start understanding how the density, temperature, and mass profiles are varying with radius or increasing with radius. And we can do a lot of other secondary science of baryon fraction, Lyman baryon fraction of radius, and then also, ultimately, we kind of tie this back to the blind cluster. We really want to understand our SC scaling relations, particularly the SC flux to mass scaling relation. And so for these clusters, we can really measure them out. It's a large radii. They're really bright, so for a given micro-K sensitivity map on the sky, we're still kind of probing the outskirts of these more massive clusters more easily. And then they have a lot of existing data on these clusters already, so we can potentially leech off of others' work for observations for X-ray and optical to kind of learn about our sample. And then also, we will offer deep observations at 220 gigahertz, so you can in principle do some kinematic SC studies and potentially measure that in a handful of clusters. So this is the cluster list that we've measured in the 2008 observing season. So in 2008, we only had 150 gigahertz and 220 gigahertz data effectively. So we started off by just doing a straight luminosity cut to select sample. Basically, any cluster south of minus 35 degrees declination with X-ray flux of 6 × 10⁴ ergs, and then try to fill that in with a couple relaxed systems. We've included every locus cluster sample, which from Graham Smith et al, because we knew there'd be a lot of data coming from that, from X-ray lensing in the near future, and understanding sort of bias in the scan relations ultimately going to be very important for us. And all the clusters that we've picked are mostly in between redshift 0.15 and 0.35, and then the highest one is 0.65. So it's mainly supposed to be kind of a fairly low redshift sample to calibrate any sort of scaling relation. And I think all of these clusters but one almost all these clusters have archived Chandra or XMM data, and I think only one has not been observed by either. So this is some pictures of SPT cluster maps. Basically, for each of these clusters, we go out and do one of these 2 by 2 degree patches of observations on them and get down to about 15 micro-K noise. And these are kind of 9 of the brighter clusters, really. A lot of the structure that you see is usually fairly obvious when you look at the maps, what structure probably likely CMB and what might be noise. Some of these clusters on the bottom are a little dimmer, so you see some more noise fluctuations. But then a lot of this stuff up here is large-scale CMB. The noise is, like in this map, it's only about 10 micro-K. So those are significant measures of the CMB. And so from this data alone, there's Daisuke and others talk a lot about measuring pressure profiles in clusters. So that CFF is directly measuring the pressure profile. So since we're observing these really massive bright clusters, we can kind of, in principle, be able to distinguish different kind of physics of different pressure profiles and distinguish which ones kind of match our results better. And one big advantage that SZ has over X-ray is that, in principle, since SZ intensity only goes like the line of sight integral electron density times temperature, versus X-ray goes like density squared, in principle, you can probe out into the outer regions of the cluster because you lose less fast in terms of mapping the outer regions. So for this reason, like SBT can potentially offer something to expand on the X-ray data just because it can possibly probe out a little farther. Of course, as you get to smaller signals, you have control of these CMB and other contaminants on larger scales also is important. So hopefully the multi-frequency aspect of SBT also becomes more important to reduce those systematic effects. This is just an example of several CMB temperature profiles, all rescaled to the same normalization as measured by SBT, and then put into physical unit, so radius, megaparsecs. So if you just take a radial binning of a lot of these clusters and measure the pressure, the CMB decrement profile, you can see there's a very significant detections of emission out to really large radii. For these clusters, R500 is about 1.2 megaparsecs for most of these guys.
pretty much on the sky.
Yeah.
And so, but in principle, we should actually see something because there's no radio halo in these maps.
Yeah. No, we do see something. I mean, part of the problem with AFB-667 is as you're going to kind of these closer clusters, you're getting to larger scales, and you have more CMB confusion. So it becomes even more important to get multi-frequency data. And in some ways, that's why the high redshift clusters that FTP is trying to find are great, because they're arc minute size scale things. So there's pretty much no CMB you can get away with it. But then for A367, there's several CMB bumps around there, clearly, that are making the map harder just to look at and see what's going on. And for that, we're definitely the multi-frequency data is going to be crucial to try to understand what's going on there. But I mean, we do have a nice detection of it. Okay, so tying this all back to the blind clusters, I'm not really going to say much here either, but we really want to be using these targeted clusters as a way to inform us about how we're fitting the blind clusters. We want to try to understand, kind of pick well-motivated pressure profiles to more accurately and hopefully with less scatter predict our total mass of our objects. And then at some level, the multi-frequency, not only in SPT, but in other wavelengths, will be really important to try to understand confusion in a lot of these objects. This is one. This is another cluster from the 23-hour field that only a few people know about. But this is an image at 9150 and 220. And if you just do the 150 gigahertz map analysis from last year, it comes out it's one of the most significant clusters at 150 gigahertz. Just going to run in a cluster finder. And then we observed it this summer at 90, and it comes out really bright. But then if you look at the 220 gigahertz data, you can see there's probably a lens background of the galaxy like right on top of it. So things like this, I mean, to some degree, if there's been a lot of work on estimating the effects of these things with clusters and how that affects cosmological parameters. But we're going out and directly measuring it with SVT to understand these source populations. And also, the thing that we really worry about is if there's some how these things are correlated with clusters to a level that we don't know about, especially on the AGN side, because there's not as many measurements there. All right, so that's the summary. SVT is working great. It's taking a lot of deep multi-frequency maps. We're right now in the process of kind of better understanding our time stream filtering pipeline, just to make sure that we can make unbiased multi-frequency maps of these clusters. And we have a lot of deep observations of these massive, well-studied systems, which we hope to answer a lot of questions about thermodynamics of the outer reaches of these clusters, pick better models to more accurately estimate the masses of the clusters, and then how that feeds back into our SC scaling relations. We really want to tie this into the blind clusters eventually and have this force us develop a multi-frequency SC X-ray pipeline. A lot of these blind clusters are going to have targeted X-ray follow-up or already had to some degree. And this will hopefully inform us on that pipeline. Thanks.
Maybe you said it, and I missed it. If you look at those that you have targeted now, even from the known clusters at the larger radii,
mm-hmm.
How does the profile look there? How does it compare with what we cannot see it in X-rays in most cases? But what can you say about the larger radii?
I mean, it's they I probably can't say too much, but for many of the clusters, they look roughly like you'd expect. I mean, even a beta model doesn't fit the clusters too poorly going out to near the virial radius in some of the clusters. But so I think now we're just trying to also try to fit as many different pressure profiles as possible, and with definitely an eye towards understanding which profiles are fitting the best out there. So to zeroth order, it looks like, you know, we can't tell at this point whether a beta model or a modified NFW like Nagai like profile works better or what. But
But can you say that the gas fraction increases as you go to the higher radian?
Well, that's really hard to say because we'd want a better estimate of the total mass, which we really don't have at this point. We'd need X-ray data, and we'd really need to be probably pushing the limits of the X-ray data also to go out past R500, and that's definitely going to be a big research project, understanding that data.
So when you show these beautiful radial profiles, are these the filter radial profiles that we cannot actually fit the data
right
directly to the model, or
there,
these are others got?
All the profiles that I showed were actually from the mass pipeline of where it's really only removing the like a first or second order polynomial from the map and then masking the cluster. And so you can definitely fit something to it, but then it's just a matter of how much of it is CMB, or you'd have to just kind of do some sort of extra something to try to spatially filter the maps to really say what might be the actual SDS model. But then there would be a large systematic slice potentially there.
So when should we expect actual comparisons between models and data?
Sometime this year. I think we're in the process right now of finalizing the SE pipeline, and probably on the order of sometime this summer we'll have a paper that's just an SE only, laying out the pipeline, laying out the multi-frequency analysis, and then we're kind of just getting in the process of mining the archive of Chandra XMM data, but we really haven't done much as far as that goes. We're still trying to finalize the SE pipeline.
I have a question regarding the Photon cluster. So do you plan to do a sort of synthetic comparison between the Chandra data and your data, or?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean,
do you have your opinions, for example?
Well, not. I mean, it's the same sort of answer where we're kind of still trying to find the SE pipeline. I mean, we've done some like crude comparisons, like certain with this Mark Emission All Public Data map, but we haven't actually went in and analyzed the data or joined it ourselves.
You already have the data from New season.
Yeah.
These improved detectors. Maybe it's also special to you. And could you tell us how much better is the sensitivity now at 150?
Well, 2008 was a really good year as well. So, and then 2009, we replaced half the focal planes. And 90 gigahertz is. That's a lot better, but that's basically because our 2008 sensitivity 90 was basically zero. But like at 150, it's the mapping speed should be roughly a factor of two better at 150 this year versus last year.
In delta T,
yeah, in delta T.
Well, no,
oh, mapping speed. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Root two and delta T.
This is my question. Okay. And do you have also improvement at 220 gigahertz or not?
We actually have it's a little worse at 220 gigahertz this year than last year. But I mean, not much worse. Not much worse. I think, it's going to be like a root 1.7, I think, effects in F220, which, you know, is like 1.3 or something. So it's probably about 30% worse than delta T. But, I mean, that was because we were trying to, ultimately, if we're finding clusters, 220 doesn't really help you at all. And so you want to basically have as minimum the amount to, like, help you constrain the point source population. But that's only more important for some, it's more important, becomes proportionally more important for smaller clusters. So you really, until you get your, 15 micro K CMB maps at other frequencies, it doesn't help you so much. So last year was really, we tried to put as many SZ sensitive wedges in as possible. So, but there's the most sensitive 220 wedges in. So, it'll still be 30 within 30% of the mapping speed of last year.
It was very impressive. You told that you are expecting EFSZ from bullet cluster of 140 microk, and you showed us the picture and the image of the soul depth profile,
mm-hmm.
and we saw that you are following the profile up to 20 micro-K, which was significant.
Yeah, yeah.
Even 20 micro-K. Therefore, your error bars are the level of few micro-K.
Yeah.
Therefore, it seems that if your estimate is correct, then you are really speaking about 20 sigma or 15 sigma.
Right, at that rate, yeah, yeah. So you're averaging, I mean, the noise per pixel isn't necessarily that good, but you're just averaging so many pixels together in that radial bin that you get down to that level where you have a few micro-K noise.
But, okay, and I remember that John Karlstrom showed in Munich during the Cosmology Dark Matter conference.
Mm-hmm.
He showed another very rich cluster where error bars were even smaller and where we do not hear about so huge variations of the temperature inside.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, maybe they even are better for KSZ. But it was very interesting. It was maybe the most rich cluster on the southern.
That's pretty much the same actually luminosity as the bullet. So it's one of the other brights.
But it is more relaxed than the stencil.
Well, it's a merger, but it's along the line of sight, so it looks really spherical and looks.
Oh, but this
relaxed.
Is better than KSZ.
Yeah, for KSZ, it's actually
KSZ
better.
For KSZ, it's much better.
And for that one, I just don't know the line of sight velocity, but. Mm-hmm. It's a major merger, so it's probably on the order of 700 kilometers per second.
And there are now reports about these three cluster mergers, maybe.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But this is Northern Sky, as I understand. Yes.
So that's right.
It's Northern Sky.
It's Northern.
What was that?
AP5520. It's too far north.
Yes,
and that's
north.
A sort of anti-bullet burn.
Yeah,
basically,
AP5520 is a very nice apex observation. It's actually in the can and being analyzed right now.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, SEA must have observed it too. Yeah.
But for you, it is already 2 nodes. Yes.
For SBT, it is, but apex has a not nice observation.
Chigo also has some. Good. Yes. Okay.
I had a question regarding these less dusty galaxies on a cluster. How often do you see this?
I don't know that we know well.
It's only blazingly obvious once.
Okay, but there might be some sort of more subtle effect there. And for this, you might want to really have a good sensitivity at 220, right? To sort of really sort of.
It depends on what you're after. It's going to be a noise source that you have to deal with, and if it's actually large enough for a given cluster to impact you, then yes. But if you don't clean them out, it's just a noise source. It doesn't bias you in any way.
I mean, it always contributes to the flux, right?
No, because it's lensing, so it preserves flux.
Oh,
but it's correlated with clusters.
No.
Well, the noise is. It's a little extra noise at the center.
But it's not, this flux isn't correlated with the cluster. You could be lensing a blind region of sky that has no sources in it at all, so you just get a big hole instead, a source. It has zero flux, net flux.
Maybe I do not understand something, but SCUBA had a lot of such lensing infrared galaxies. But they were especially looking towards well-known clusters.
Absolutely.
And they're discovering them there.
That's a great way to find them, because it boosts their flux.
Yes, immediately.
But then they're fewer, because the sky's been stretched out, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at a smaller region of sky, the sources look brighter, there's fewer of them, and the net flux is not changed.
And specifically for SCUBA, they were confusion limited, mm-hmm. normally. And so what the lensing does is it basically takes some patch of sky and stretches it out. Means you have the same area but fewer sources per square degree, so you dig down the confusion limit.
But
that was the reason they did that.
But this is bad for that observation.
Only so long as it creates a noise source that's larger than your. That if you're not detecting the sources, it doesn't hurt you. And it's only when you start to detect them.
And as I understood, this apex source is also lensing.
Yes. Right tail.
Yes.
The bullets, as an observation, not from APUS, from Aztec, and they had a 1.3 millimeters, or 1.1 millimeters, and they see a bright source that's 14 millijanskis, looks like a lens galaxy.
Yeah.
So
this is
in
how many
galaxies do not compensate for the depletion. I mean, for the SZ in
Well, so for example,
for
the Bohr cluster, for the apex analysis, one of the things that was done was we actually fit a source on the position where we knew that there was a source from the 1 millimeter observations, and we allowed that as a free parameter and fit. And given the spectral index of the source, you don't expect to see a significant flux at 2 millimeters. At least for us, and it's true, it's consistently zero, you don't see anything. So in that particular instance, it's not as scary as you think, just because the spectral index is such. But, I guess the point is, as long as the source is, you could compromise your noise if you did not have a deep enough 220 gigahertz measurement to take out the sources. The problem is for us, because the 220 noise is worse, it is so expensive to get a deep enough 220 map to be able to subtract those sources, it's prohibitive. Actually remove the IR fluctuations.
But you don't see cases where it actually biases the results, not just increases the noise?
Well, for a given cluster, a given single cluster could bias the result, but for an ensemble of clusters, it wouldn't.
And it can bias it either way. Because you might lens a hole in the background,
okay,
and then you're comparing it to the difference around it. So if you lens up a hole, then you'll see a big cold spot there.
So for any given cluster, it just means that you go to a certain depth. And if you're at 20 sigma or something, it's probably not a big deal. But if you try to go deeper, you could get to the point where it's dominating your noise, that IR contribution. But it's just the noise source.
And will any of that depend on redshift, on the redshift of the cluster? Because you are going to lens, of course, more distant objects at higher redshift.
How much contribution there is, yes. Yeah, so perhaps when we go to higher redshift clusters, it's less of an issue. But...
But this is only true if you have a given spectral index.
Yes, exactly.
And you just saw your spectral index distribution, there was a whole distribution, then it does not cancel basically the dilution of your...
Well, it's not spectral index, it's shape of the shape of the population.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
No, it always cancels exactly. Because you're magnifying, all lensing is doing is taking some part of the sky and magnifying.
Yes.
And so the total, the mean flux in some patch of sky is going to always be the same.
Yep.
So the mean temperature of that patch is always going to be the same, but what you're doing is you're blowing up your shot noise a little bit, because instead of there being shot noise on there being 10 things in your patch, it's now shot noise on there being 4 things in that patch. So it blows up your noise, but it doesn't bias it up or down.
Well, they're uncorrelated because they're background sources. The IR sources are uncorrelated with clusters. They're background.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, they're not lens. I mean, you know, they were talking about, it could be that you could have IR sources associated with clusters, but the ones that we're seeing, at least that we think we're seeing, are lens background sources. And at least this is what when people the SCUBA sources have been followed up and looked at. But you know, when galaxy identifications are found, they're highly redshift systems.
So, what did your hypothesis say about IR sources?
Oh, you're saying in the cluster itself?
Yeah.
The observed populations so far have been peaked at redshift 2.5 or so.
But this is one of Aztec's projects, isn't it?
In the clusters themselves?
In the clusters themselves. Strangely.
Yeah,
I
don't know about that.
Okay.
Well,
I think that that's the
name. We've looked at sort of 24 micron sources in clusters, and they're rare because the star forming galaxies are in the center of clusters. Towards the edges, though, you might get more. So if you're trying to push out further out, you might get more contamination.
That's different. That's a source of bias if they actually. But radio sources are much more scary because we know that radio sources are associated with clusters, and that's a real issue to contend with.
And then they depend on ledges too.
Oh yeah, that's a real can of worms, and that's something to take into account with the involvement measurements. It's less of an issue at 150, but having 90 gigahertz, this is one of our main drivers for also having 90 gigahertz channels to be able to look for radio contamination of the sources. And I think that's probably something that will be a systematic bias. There will be some clusters that will go missing from having bright radio sources on them.
But the lensing, the fact that you have the magnification and the demagnification, wouldn't that look like some substructure in the clusters, because you'll have a little extra magnification and a little demagnification in different parts of the cluster?
Yeah, it'll cause lumpiness.
It will cause lumpiness in the SD image.
Yeah.
And it could lead to it could also lead to when you lens it up, you might see some big hole underneath it.
Why?
So it might screw up your determination of candidate.
Yeah.
It's a mess for sure.
You know, that lumpiness, though, the nice thing about it is the lumpiness is as a steep spectrum. And so, 220 gigahertz measurements like you see in this one, it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb when you look at the 220 now. And so, in principle, we can do something about it if it's a bright source.
Yeah, and also for 90, we want to follow up a lot of these clusters that with interferometers really say what the characterize the point sources at a frequency near 90 gigahertz.
Okay, thank the speakers of the session again.